Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Get his bell away? Shh. Now challenge.
Get his pedo, now chale.
Chale.
Ya sabes que a mí me vale.
Me vale.
Get his pedo, now chale.
Chale.
You know that I'm down for the high.
Welcome to Suplexes and Cervezas with Chavo Guerrero Jr. I'm your host, Chavo Guerrero Jr.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into Suplexes and Cervezas today. I'm Chavo Guerrero Jr. and what a beautiful day in Southern California again. I don't get tired of saying that. You know, there's a reason why we pay big taxes over here in California. It's because it's Southern freaking California. We get a little of everything. We love it here. Anyways, today on the podcast, we have John Bradshaw Layfield, JBL, as you want to call him sometimes, as he's known in the WWE. Great guy, man. Really good friend of the family. Controversial at times, for sure, but he's old school. This guy is as old school as it gets. He's straight up from back in the golden era of wrestling, if you want to call it. A lot of history with the Guerrero family. This guy's really been everywhere. You know, he started out in the NFL, then transitioned into pro wrestling, and is one smart cookie when it comes to finances. You know, I asked him on the pod, how did you learn to do all this stuff with your finances? And he said, man, I got tired of not having any money. So he learned how to manage his money and make the most of it. This guy, you know, like I said, has been everywhere. He started off in Dallas area, I believe, and wrestled in Japan. He's gone to Europe. He kind of went everywhere, ended up in the WWE, and kind of the rest is history, you know. On the pod today, we talk about his relationship with his old pal, one of the toughest guys in the business and one of the nicest guy also, Big Ron Simmons. Damn, as you remember him by, his motto. I've been up and down the road a few times with JBL, and what a great guy. You know, this guy is he can put away a couple Coors Lights and he can drive that golf ball over 300 yards. So this dude is he's one of the old school guys, like I said, one of our pals, one of part of the Guerrero family, we call it. And we talk about so many different things on this podcast today, so I hope you enjoy the listen. Let me know your thoughts when you get done with the podcast, and make sure you hit that subscribe button. And right now on the podcast, JBL, John Bradshaw Layfield.
Well, my dad was telling me the stories about Jack. And my dad, when he was in college, wrestling in college at UTEP, he used to study Jack Briscoe, because Jack Briscoe, if anybody's listening, he, in college, he was never, ever taken down in a college wrestling match. Never taken down. That's how good this guy was. So everybody studied him. So when my dad finally got to meet him, he was like, oh my God, this guy is like a legend. And then he's a legend out of the ring too, you know.
The Briscoes, yeah, so. That's true. In 1965, when he won the NCAA championship, Jerry was on the 1968 team that won the national championship. Jack never got taken down, not one time the entire year. It's one of the greatest amateur records of all time. He had been the gold medalist. I mean, he had done whatever he wanted. They just didn't have any money, and there wasn't any medals. Right. There wasn't any money in being a gold medalist, and that's why Jack was not a gold medalist. He could have been world champion. He could have done whatever he wanted.
That's exactly what my dad told me. I was like, well, did he go to the Olympics? And he's like, well, no, why not? He's like, well, you got to pay bills.
Yeah, no. Jerry dropped out of school right after the 68 season and went straight into pro wrestling because same reason, he didn't have any money. You know, they grew up on, I think, a Chickasaw, Choctaw. Is it Choctaw or Chickasaw? Maybe a combination of the two, reservation. And didn't have any money. And so to them, going to college wasn't going to get them much of any place anyway. They knew they could make money in wrestling.
Right, right. And those guys were smart. You know, I remember their Briscoe Brothers body shop, you know, and they were – I loved that shirt. I had one of those shirts, you know, so.
You know, I inducted them in the Hall of Fame.
I was there, and I remember, and I remember your speech was so not PC to now this today.
Oh, my God. They told me right before it, and both of them had a couple drinks before the Hall of Fame. And they told me, they said, John, listen, whatever you do, because I had sent Gerald Briscoe subscriptions to like Texas Monthly, Texas Parks and Wildlife, all kinds of Texas magazines. And they'd go to his house every single month. I did it for years. I sent him cards on Columbus Day. I sent him cards on Thanksgiving. Because for those that don't know, Jerry's I think 7/8 Choctaw native. And so always because of the Texas and the cowboy and the native, I would send him stuff on Columbus Day on Thanksgiving. So I had the history of ribs with them and them on me. And they told me, said, whatever you do, don't say anything. Don't tell a native joke. Do not do that when you get out there. And I said, guys, listen, this is the Hall of Fame. This is too serious. I would not do something like that at the Hall of Fame. And the first thing I said was, I said, I walk in, there's Jerry and Jack standing by this door. And I said, hey, guys, this isn't a cigar store. You can come in. And I told one night a joke every day. You couldn't get away with that today. You know, Jerry Briscoe, I used to take pictures of wooden Indians all over the world. And he had a wooden Indian as his profile pic. And I would send him a pic, say, hey, Jerry, I'm thinking about you. We're good friends now. Understand that. So Jerry thought it was funny and put it on his Twitter that I had sent him this picture of his wooden Indian. I got called racist this, racist that. He's got a picture of wooden Indian on his profile picture.
If you go back and listen, anybody listen, you got to go back and see that. What year was that, the Hall of Fame speech?
Like 08 or something? I can't remember. Yeah, 05? I can't remember.
Yeah, you got to go back and see it because it's first of all, John, JBL is gold on the microphone. You give him the microphone, that guy would just talk. But and just make sense and not ramble. He doesn't pull a Paul Lee where he just keeps talking. It's just bullshit. He actually says he meets them and it's great. It's entertaining. But then this video, I mean this induction to the Hall of Fame, it is the funniest thing. But it like if you listen to it now, you're gonna cringe, going, oh my God. Uh-huh. You can't – it's all such – talking about the reservations and – oh, my gosh.
You get thrown off the air now if you said what all I said back then. It was all the – you know, it's all comedy. It's all work.
It's working. It was all good.
And they were in on it. You know, they thought it was funny. It wasn't like it was taking shots at them. You know, it was just fun.
We all did. That was the best speech of the night. We were all laughing, and you had the whole place rolling. It was great.
I told him my great-grandfather was a famous Navajo chief, Big Chief Slapaho.
Slap-a-ho, exactly. Too funny, man. My favorite part about these podcasts is catching up with my friends because we don't get to see each other anymore, you know, at a funeral or a Hall of Fame or something like that, but we really don't really get to hang out together anymore. And that's what I miss the most about wrestling. Sure, getting in the ring, absolutely, but I miss the time with the boys. I miss the camaraderie with the boys, you know.
Yeah, I do too. That to me is the thing that I miss the most. You know, you'd love to be able to be young again and be in the ring and, you know, have hopefully good matches with people. But
right,
sitting in the back and just bullshitting and having fun, that was the time of my life. I mean, God, we had so much fun. You know, people don't understand, you know, especially back in the day, as they say, we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have the internet. So when we get in a car, you know, three or four of us to go to the next town, all we had was each other. So we had to be entertaining. We'd have a few beers. We'd tell stories. That's where all those road stories came from. You know, I don't know if we'd have had cell phones and internet, if maybe we'd be like the guys today and be on our phones and checking all our social media and doing different stuff. We didn't have that option. And so we had just had each other, and good Lord, did we have some fun times.
Just the times in the bars, just having – we couldn't wait to get done, get to the next town so we could – okay, well, we got 2 hours. Get to the bar quick, right?
Where there were some guys I don't know. We were in Ireland, and some guy was trying to start a fight with you, And he had a golf club or something with him. Remember that? And so the guy's in the bar with the golf club. And finally, I'm sitting there, and Undertaker's sitting maybe a one or two down from me. And I look in the mirror, which you can see the mirror in the bar, and you can see behind you. And Taker goes, "Grab him!" And I realize right away it's you. And I can see you in the mirror, and I reach like this, and I grab you. And you're walking toward the guy. And I said, "Chavo, what are you doing?" You go, "Nothing." And I said, "Chavo, where's your watch?" And you'd put it in your pocket. I said, "You're just going to do nothing." And you go, "I'm just going to go talk to him." "Chavo, that's a really bad idea."
Absolutely. Oh, man, that was in Dublin. We were in Dublin.
That's right.
Yeah, and that little bar from right around the corner from the hotel. And I put that watch, my tag. I put my $1,000 tag watch in my pocket. Okay, I can't break this. Put it in my pocket, and this guy was just talking crap. I was gonna go talk to him.
Yeah, he wanted to fight. He wanted to fight badly. And you'd finally had enough. And
I was take ready.
You know, grab him. And then the only thing that stopped you from beating up this guy was I was able to grab you at the last second.
And then I had Fit Finley, and Fit Finley was there and going, "Whew, Chavo, good thing they stopped you. He would have kicked your ass."
Yeah. Fit was the best.
It was awesome. He posted something on his social media today, and it was Fit's all soft and nice now, and he's holding his glass.
Boy, that's an act.
Oh, my God. Right. That's a, what do you call it? A not a double entendre, but with a two-meaning thing, like a jumbo shrimp, right?
Right.
A nice
oxymoron.
Oxymoron. So he's holding this picture. He's holding like a big grasshopper, and he says, "Hey, I made a new friend." So I replied, "Just don't snap marry him and kick him in the back, because he won't like you anymore."
Fit knocked my tooth out, which this side, because it was his right hand. So we wrestled one time in Hanover, and they booked, you know, heel versus heel, two stiff guys. You know, they just wanted to see two stiff guys go at it. So Finley caught me with a clothesline right early in the match, and I knew he caught me well, and I thought he'd, you know, busted my tooth, but I wasn't sure. So he came to me after the match, and he goes, "Hey, John, thanks for the match." I said, "Hey, thank you, Dave. It was great." He said, "I didn't catch you on anything, did I?" I said, "No, it's a dream. Didn't feel anything," which really pissed him off, because he knew he had caught me at the clothesline. He wanted me to admit it, and I wouldn't admit it. So he goes, "I didn't catch you on anything?" And you could tell he's disappointed. I said, "Hey, you're a dream, man. I don't know what people complain about. You were light as a feather." And as he walks off, I've got a little sandwich by my locker, because we were there every single day and I had a little food there. And I bit into it, and my tooth fell out. And I said, "Damn it, he knocked out my tooth." And he was right around the corner. He came back in. He goes, "I knew it." He was all excited about it.
Oh, my God. He's the stories of Fit that he was – we met a tamed – a turned down Fit, a tamed Fit. But there are stories of him when he was in Germany, and he would just walk into a bar and just push everybody away to the side and just walk right in. And people would say, like, "Hey, wrestling, is it fake?" "Oh, yeah, absolutely." "Oh, it is? Yeah, let me see your hand." And he'd break your finger. Just break your finger.
Thumb. Yeah, he'd break a finger or a thumb. Yeah, that is 100% true story. I saw Fit one time, and Brad Armstrong, the legendary Armstrong family, had probably the great one of the greatest matches I've ever seen in my life in Bremen, Germany. They went we used to go rounds there, and I remember, forget how many rounds they went, maybe 10 or 12 rounds, which was, I think you went three or four minute rounds. I can't remember what it was. Right. But it was a long time, and, man, what a freaking match. I mean, Fit could go. Fit was the best heel I've ever seen. You know, when he was in Europe, and you were in Bremen and Hanover, Vienna and Graz, he had to be there every single week. I mean, every single day for several weeks, every single year. He was the main heel there for 15, 20 years. I mean, it's an he had one of the best runs I've ever seen as a heel. He was the best heel I've ever seen.
Yeah, he was an incredible wrestler. So good. I remember when he first came into WCW. So the first time I met him, I was still living with Eddie training for wrestling, and I had to go. It was Super Bowl Sunday. The Dallas Cowboys were playing, my team of all teams, and they're playing the Bills, and I had to go into Juarez, Mexico to go wrestle, right? So, and it was Dave, Finley and Dave Taylor were at Eddie's house, and they were getting their visas squared up so that they could wrestle in WCW. So Eddie, you know, hosted them and had some beer for them and stuff. And, you know, I'm getting ready to watch the game. Well, I'm sitting there like polishing my boots, getting my boots all shiny. And they're laughing at me. They're like, look at this kid polishing his boots. So I'm looking at him, you know, and I've just had probably 10 matches, you know, and I look at him, I go, hey guys, so what's your, you try to make conversation, you know, so what's your favorite kind of beer? And Fit just goes, cold, and drinks his beer. He didn't say, just a cold.
Like, Ben is a okay. funny guy, especially okay. back then. He was sharp, man. He had a sharp tongue. He was funny. Fit was a shark, man. He was something else. You know, and he was a heel 24/7, especially in, you had to be in Europe because you lived there. You couldn't let the people see right. you get out of character. You know, and people talk about how The Undertaker was in character for 20 straight years, and then a heel does it, and you go, people say, oh, what an asshole. Okay, so one was professional, one's an asshole. You know, exactly. To me, that's the guys that made money. And were the guys that were able to make people believe they were that person. Of course, Finley was that person. He was a heel.
That's who we learn from. You and I learn from that. So to just even get into that, who trained you wrestling?
Brad Rheingans up in Minnesota.
Oh, wow.
You know,
oh, wow.
Brad trained, you know, Big Van Vader, trained Brock Lesnar. Brad was probably the best trainer there was back then. I just played, you know, a little bit in the NFL, in the World Football League, the World League of American Football. And I met somebody who had wrestled in Japan. And they said the way to do it is to go get trained. And I didn't know anybody. And I said, well, who's the best trainer? And he said, Brad Rheingans. And I literally called Brad cold. And I said, hey, I just got released out of the World League of American Football. I want to be a wrestler. And I said, what do I do? He said, well, you come up to Minnesota, you live up here for a few months, and I'll train you. And $2,500, I'll train you in my basement, and we'll send you off. And so that's what I did. Went up there and didn't know Brad, didn't know anybody. Drove up there, got a little place that Brad arranged for me to get. And because of the name of Brad, I got jobs almost right away. I went down to Texas. I got a job right away. Kendo Nagasaki, Mr. Sakurada from Japan, got to go over. He had just split with Tenryu in war and caused his own group of wrestlers over there in Japan, mainly Tokyo. And so I got to go to Japan right away. But all of it came about because of Brad. Brad was a great trainer. Great guy, too. You know, Brad was a 1980 Greco-Roman world champion, and he would have been the gold medalist, but that's the year that they boycotted the Olympics because of Russia, and Jimmy Carter didn't want to, you know, deal with Russia.
Right, that's right, that's right. And you grew up, obviously, in Texas, Texas boy, Texas pride, but you were a heck of a high school football player.
Yeah, right? I was All-State, and you know, zone small American teams as a high school player. I was actually later named to the All-Century team for the West Texas football, which included, you know, Mojo Magic and Friday Night Lights, that area. Then I went to my local college because that's where I wanted to go, Abilene Christian. I ended up making All-American a couple times there. And just got put in the Hall of Fame there a couple years ago. Made the All-Century team there. Nice. A few years before that. Then I went and played a little professional football. Didn't play much. You know, I like to think it was because of injuries. I had a lot of injuries. I had four knee surgeries in college. You know, it may have been a lack of ability. I'd like to think it was all of the surgeries I had and the fact that I wasn't quite the athlete I was when I got out of college because I'd had so many surgeries.
Right, right. And then you went going into football. You train. I mean, going to wrestling. Scratch that. Start again. You get into wrestling, get trained by Brad Rheingans, and then where's your first territory?
Dallas. So I came back to Texas, and I think it's an interesting story. I wrestled the first night for Killer Tim Brooks, made $10 at the Villa Inn in Garland, Texas. I showed up, and I said, hey, I want to wrestle tonight. And he goes, I can't pay you much money, kid. And I said, look, I just want to wrestle. I've never had a match before. And he said, you never had a match? I said, no, I want to wrestle. And he said, well, who trained you? I said, Brad Rheingans. Once I told him that, he goes, yeah, we'll put you in the ring. So they put me in the ring. That was Wednesday. On Friday, I showed up to the Sportatorium, and Lou Perez, who was Al Perez's working cousin. I don't think they were really related. No-showed the event. I have no idea what happened. I say he no-showed. I don't know if it was travel or, you know, it was something. Who knows what happened?
He wasn't there and you had your gear.
I was there and I had my gear. Rod Price was the champion, and they said, we don't have a main event. He said, what do we do? And they said, we got this big kid that wrestled at the Villa Inn. He was trained by Brad Rheingans, again, Brad's name. And they said, let's stick him in the main event in the Sportatorium with the champion and see what happens. So they told Rod, said, go with him 20 minutes if you can. And if he's horrible, go with him 2 minutes. So that was Rod was a great worker. We went 20 minutes. And Kendo Nagasaki saw that match, but he didn't see me wrestle. So if he'd have seen me wrestle, he'd have known how green I was. And he came to me after the match and he said, what's your background? I said, well, I played some pro football. I was trained by Brad Rheingans. Just wrestled tonight. He goes, you want to come to Japan? Guys spent their whole lives, never made it to Japan. I got booked there on my second night in the business. It was unbelievable. 3 weeks later or so, I'm in Japan working, and I'm tag teaming with Bob Orton, Randy Orton's dad. Wow. Bob asked me one time, he goes, you know, kid, you do some stuff that's really good, but some of the stuff you do makes no sense. How long you been in the business? And I said, 2 weeks, sir. And he goes, no, not how long have you been in Japan? How long have you been in the business? I said, 2 weeks, sir. And he goes, the hell are you doing here? Because back then, they would eat you alive. And they loved eating me alive. They wouldn't try me at the beginning. They'd blow me up. And then at the end, they would just stretch me and beat me with chairs. And it was a long 5 weeks.
Japanese style, brother, Japanese style. And that's when it was – they didn't play around. The strong style was 100%. Yep. It was – The line between shoot and work was so gray there. My father, I remember him, the first time he went was, must have been 70, late 73 or early 74, and he convinced Dory Funk. Dory Funk was booking for Baba over there at All Japan, and he actually goes, there was a spot open, so he was begging Dory Funk, can I please go? Dory, the Amarillo boys were running through my grandpa's territory over there in El Paso. So, of course, Guerreros and Funks have intertwined for years and years and years. In fact, Terry was a big mentor for my father. So my dad's, he's begging Dory, and Dory's like, kid, you're not ready. You're just not ready. I understand you, you know, you're Gory Guerrero's son. You're just not ready. And finally, he convinced him. He went. But dad did well, but it was such a highlight. My dad talked about that his entire life. I mean, all of the other tours, of course, but that first tour, getting that chance from Dory Funk, was one of his highlights, man.
Yeah, I wasn't ready to go at that time. And thank God for Bob Orton. You know, I loved Bob Orton from the first time I met him. Just a wonderful, wonderful human being. And those that have seen Bob Orton work, man, that punch that Randy throws, he got it from his dad. Bob Orton was a great worker. And by the way, people always ask about that mid-rope suplex. I asked Bob about it one time. He got it from Scott Irwin. Scott Irwin was the first to do that. It was Bill Irwin's brother. You know, who passed away, Scott did at a young age. But Bob would get me in the morning and he'd show me a bunch of sugar holds, show me a bunch of shoot holds, let me survive that night. You know, and by the time that the tour was over, I was doing okay. My cardio had caught up and I'd learned enough wrestling, but man, it was baptism by fire. The first few days and the first few weeks were pretty rough over there in Japan.
Oh yeah, my first match, I got inducted very, very fast. I was 4 months into WCW, probably 6 months into my wrestling career, and they said, hey, we're going to send you to Japan for the Super J Cup. All right, cool, no problem. So I called my dad up. Dad, I'm going to Japan. And he's like, okay, great. So I go, you know, what's your advice? You know, what do you think? What's your advice for me? And he goes, this is the God's only truth. He goes, beat the fuck out of him. And I'm like, I go, okay. So like what? He goes, no, beat the fuck out of him. And I'm like, but like we're working right here. We're working here and stuff. Right. I was kind of agreed, but kind of didn't get it. My very first match, my very first tie up with Kenji Kanemoto, I tied up We went to the corner, to the turnbuckle. My hands went down, and he slapped me so hard, broke my eardrum. This is the very first tie-up in Japan. Slapped me, broke my eardrum. My ear starts bleeding, and I'm like, oh, that's what my dad meant about it. And it was
it
like,
was
either
not
you,
real, man.
You fight.
I've been in street
fights. Beat up.
Yeah. I've been in street fights that are easier than some of those matches. I'm telling you, man, it was tough and it was stiff. Bob Orton tagged me in one time. He goes, "We're going over, kid, but we ain't giving them shit. Don't give them nothing." It just sucked. Bob, I'm not sure I got the cardio not to give them nothing.
No, absolutely. But
that's how it was, man. You had to watch them. You know, it wasn't like they were bad guys or we were bad guys, but, you know, guys just really didn't trust each other, and you're always trying to take a little bit of advantage and trying to figure out where your spot was on the card. And it was really – it was an alpha male business back then.
Huge alpha male. And I've said that – I've stressed that before anybody listened. There was no MMA back then. The toughest guys in the world were the pro wrestlers, bar none. You didn't get into the wrestling business unless you could prove that you were tough as nails, and then they would be like, oh, all right, maybe we'll train them. You had to prove your worth. Then they'd train you to be a wrestler. And then all of a sudden, you know, they didn't even smarten you up for the first 6 months, so you guys you're fighting. You're actually fighting in there. They respected this business so much that you could not even – break foot into the business unless you were a tough, tough, tough guy. It was awesome.
Yeah. One time we were in the ring, me and Bobby Duncombe Jr. were in the ring with Gary Hart, one of his nephews, and Gary had trained him, and we thought this is going to be okay. Gary's a great worker. Gary hadn't smartened him up. And so I get in the ring with this kid. He's not smart to the business. He thinks it's to shoot, and we're going at it. So finally I got him tied down. I tag in Bobby. I said, "Bobby, get ready." I said, "You don't know what to expect." Guys did that all the time back then. Killer Kim Brooks told me he was in the business for months before they even smartened him up.
Yeah. Yeah. So anybody listening, smartening up is telling you that wrestling is entertainment. I don't use the fake word because that's absolutely not what it is at all. But it's the smart up, like it's entertainment. We're there to put on a show. We do it physical, like by physical entertainment. We do very, very physical, but we're there to put on a show. But when you don't smarten somebody up, they still think that it's that, especially back then, that you're in there for a fight, you know.
And think about this. These guys were actually – there were guys that weren't smartened up that were treating it like a shoot, going against guys that were actually working, you know, and carrying them a certain length of time. Arnie Scollin, you know, the golden boy.
Arnold.
Used to always tell the story. He had been around the loop for months, maybe 6 months. And finally he won a match and he thought, oh my God. He goes, "I finally won a match." And he said, "It looks like," he said, "I probably expect a fight in the dressing room." So he walked back to the dressing room and everybody was just laughing. And that's how they smartened him up. The guy let him beat him. Let him beat him. I mean, Arnie still beat the guy and it still was he still wasn't smartened up.
Wow, that's amazing. So you're in world-class wrestling in Dallas. Were you at Sportatorium?
Sportatorium, yeah. It was global wrestling at that time, right past the Von Erichs.
Right after world-class.
Right after world-class, it was global wrestling. They had a deal with ESPN. They had a deal with some local TV stations. So ESPN was actually pretty good exposure. They didn't – we had a sellout every single Friday night, but no one bought a ticket. They gave tickets away, but they made them pay for parking and beer and hot dogs and stuff, and that's how they got people packed in that arena. I mean, it held like, I don't know what, 2,000, 2,500 people, but it was full almost every Saturday. And then at that time, Kerry had just come back from the WWE for a while. Kevin was there. Yeah. The Freebirds came back during that time. It was a pretty cool time. Business wasn't like it was back in the late 80s because this was the early 90s. It already taken that down. But it's pretty cool to have those guys back and have huge crowds that were still on fire.
Oh, I mean, this is the rock star persona, the rock star aura of Kerry and Kevin. Amazing, right?
I tell you, when people ask me who's the biggest star I've been around, of course, I think probably The Rock. You know, he carries himself like a star, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in a very good way.
Right.
And he always has. Kerry Von Erich was like that. I mean, it's like being around Bruce Springsteen. I don't know a name bigger enough to say how big Kerry was in Texas at that time. He carried himself like a rock star, and that's how he was treated. He had this humble attitude where he'd say, "How you doing? I'm Kerry Von Erich," and people would just swoon over themselves. I mean, it was amazing. Kevin was the same way. I loved Kevin. Kevin, you know, still doing well out in out in Hawaii right now. Wow. My first big match was with Kevin for the NWA Championship, and it was. I felt really bad because I was such in awe of Kevin and being in the ring with him. It wasn't a very good match. And I've always felt bad about that because it was 100% my fault. It wasn't Kevin's. Kevin was great. We later had some matches I thought that were very good, but I always felt bad about that. That first big match when he actually dropped the title to me, which was very thankful. And also that added to me, here's this guy who's a champion who I grew up watching and I idolized him and still did. I wanted to ask him for an autograph and a picture, make sure somebody got this on tape. And the match was just not very good. And I always felt bad about that, but it was because I had so much respect for Kevin.
I went and visited them. I was in Kauai for a vacation, and they're like, "Chavo, come, please come." You know, they're so gracious. Come.
He's a good dude. Kevin's a good guy. He means every word of that, by the way. Kevin would welcome you, man. Kevin's one of the nicest guys I've ever met.
Yeah, and his kids are the same way. They're so awesome. I did go over there, and they showed me. I mean, it was amazing. They had their own. They have like this 8 acres in Kauai with their own waterfalls and their streams, and they have like, you know, it's like a compound. It looks like, you know, they have the Von Erich compound. They got like 6 houses, and each one of them has a house. They have their own tilapia pond where they just go out and just fish and just grab for dinner. And they think that fishing is like so easy because they just put their hook in and they just grab dinner like 2 seconds because they're not doing it for sport, and they just eat it. And it's pretty amazing. I mean, they have the waterfalls and they were super gracious. It was an experience I'll never forget for sure. And, you know, Kevin came out and said hi to all of us and hung out. He was really cool to see.
Kevin's a good guy. He seems to be very at peace in life. You know, I think he was the sole benefactor of that championship library that they had. Mm-hmm. And so when they end up selling that, they sold it to DeVince or whoever they sold it to initially. Mm-hmm. You know, Kevin, unfortunately, and good for him, he was able to get that money from that. And I think so now he lives pretty comfortably, from what I understand. And I hope so, because he certainly deserves it.
Yeah, for sure. How did you end up getting the call to go to New York?
I got a call
first. Everybody listening, New York is WWF, WWE.
I got the call first to go to work for Otto and Peter in Europe. So the year before, Larry Cameron had died in the ring in Bremen, Germany, actually in the ring against Tony St. Clair. He died during the break of in between rounds, but it was during the match. Mm. You know, thank goodness Tony didn't have a hold or something. They always thought that something was suspect about it. None of the Americans would go back, which added to the fact they thought something was suspect about that death. So they had to replace the entire American crew. And Jimmy Suzuki, remember the Japanese reporter?
Yeah, Jimmy.
He was in the office with Otto Vance. I'd send him tapes. I'd send him pictures. I'd send him resume. I'd send him all this stuff. And I'd send him a ton of stuff. Otto grew up with Arnold Schwarzenegger in Graz. They were childhood chums. Otto's a legend. Otto held a Guinness World Record for ripping phone books in half. You know, this big barrel-chested guy. Typical Austrian. Loves to drink beer and laugh and tell stories. So he needs one person. He has one person left he needs for the roster. And literally Jimmy Suzuki's sitting there and he goes, "Oh, you have a picture of John Hawk." He goes, "I know John. He's a good boy." And Otto goes, "Okay, I'll take him." And that was it. He didn't look at my pictures. He didn't look at my tapes. He took me because of Jimmy Suzuki. And that was probably my biggest break, you know, up until going to WWE. So I was over there for 2 years, worked in Graz, Wien, worked in Hanover, Bremen, a bunch of other towns, Zeeboden, several other towns in the areas. And then finally, late of the next year, I got a call. Literally, they told me to go down to the payphone. Bruce Pritchard's calling me from the WWE, and he and Pat Patterson. I walked down there in the rain. I'm standing there with an umbrella. I'm the biggest dumbass in the world. And the phone rang. This payphone in Germany rang, and it was Bruce Pritchard and Pat Patterson. They said, "Hey, we want you to do a tryout match when you come back from Germany this year. So I went back, had a tryout match with Savio Vega, who's terrific worker, the right guy,
right,
and got right. hired by Gerald Briscoe on the spot. And that was December of 1995, and I never dreamed I would be there ever since.
How the heck were we on the road with no cell phones, no GPSs? We're lost for 15 years. I don't understand like how we did it. It's so much different. The guys on the road now that with cell phones calling home, I mean, there was nothing. When I first started, and you're 8 years before me, as far as 10 years before me, as far as your wrestling career, I had a pager when I first started. It was a pager, and you're getting a call at a payphone on the street in the rain by the WWF. Crazy, right?
Raymond, Germany. I don't know. I can't even remember. I'm sure Bruce could tell you the story about how they got the number of the payphone. I don't even remember. I don't know if they'd called somebody there and said, how do we get hold of him? I didn't have a phone in my caravan. I had a caravan that was 16 feet by six. So my first house was 64 square feet. The bathroom was in the building. We had park outside in the parking lot. We'd have to go in the building to shower and use the bathroom. And wow. Had no phones, had nothing. And literally I walked down and I get a call it a payphone in the middle of a street in Germany. And that was my call from the WWE.
Insane. It's the times have changed, brother. Times have changed tremendously. You're going to Japan, you're getting trained by Brad, you're wrestling at, you know, Global. Then you're going to living in a trailer in Germany. And then maybe you get looked at from the WWE. From the WWF, maybe. And it's weird how now it's like it's so changed to where now, like, sometimes these guys, this is their first job ever is, okay, right. Oh yeah, I'm gonna try wrestling. I'm gonna go to the Performance Center, which is amazing. I haven't seen it yet, but I hear it's incredible.
That's incredible, and good for them. You know, times have changed, but it was so different. And I don't know how I would make it now. I don't know if I could make it now. You know,
I don't think I could.
You work in all of these individual territories. And so it was kind of like recruiting for college. You know, when you recruit for college in any sport, you pick out the best of the high schools. You know, you pick out guys who are champions, you pick out guys who are all state, all American, stuff like that. It's pretty easy. You know, they got a pedigree. Now you don't know if they can even pick up the sport. And so by the time you come to WWE, you've already been champion at all these smaller places. So they know at least you've had some success at some level. And if I had never had that, I don't know how it had transferred to the WWE. I mean, that's because I thought I was ready when I came to WWE. I really did. I thought, man, I'm going to go straight to the top. Good Lord, man. I was so overwhelmed. I remember sitting there at WrestleMania in Anaheim Pond and watching Shawn rappel from the ceiling and thinking, I need to go back to Japan because I thought I don't belong here. He and Brett had that Iron Man match that day. And I just remember looking at it thinking, God, grief, man, I've made a mistake. I don't belong here. Next day, I'm in the ring with Undertaker on Live Raw. And I remember all that's in my head from the day before. You know, the lights go up, the lighters come up, and I'm sitting there. And Dutch Mantel, Zebekiah, is my manager, and he can see me panic inside. And he says, just be aggressive. Just be aggressive. And all that went through my head was that bad match that I'd had with Kevin Von Erich the first time I'd ever wrestled him. So I thought, if I err, I'm on air on the side of aggression. So I jump Taker, and I'm waffling him in the corner. I'm just laying the wood to him. And he looks up, and he goes, do I owe you something?
He just calm down.
Like, I'm done. I'm fired.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and Taker's a tough SOB when he has to be, but he doesn't want to be. He wants to work and have a good match. I could have just imagined his take on it, but that's true. You didn't make it to the WWF at the time until you were 10, 15 years in minimum. You didn't even make it there. The best of the best made it there, and that's the way it was. And then it's just a little bit changed now, but. Nothing bad, just times have changed, and I totally get it. I'm not one of those veterans that would say that, you know, like, oh, back in my day, back in this. It's just different times, different change. Changing, these kids are so much more athletic than we were. They can do so much different things. So, you know, hats off to them for sure.
Yeah, and so you know, I think it's harder for them. You know, my generation was the first generation that was able to read scripts, you know, and actually be able to be told what to do in a promo. But not kind of transcended a couple generations. At the very beginning, our guys couldn't do that. You know, our guys could ad lib anything. You say, okay, you got Kevin Von Erich in a lumberjack match at Will Rogers this Saturday night. Give us 2 minutes, go. And that's all that you would get. So you ad-libbed everything. And
sink or swim.
But they say, hey, here's what we have to have you get over. Get it in this order because we need this for television. Guys in my generation couldn't do that. Guys in this generation have a hard time doing what our guys did. And it's like you say, it's not that one side is right or one side is wrong. It's just different. It's just a different way that we grew up in the business.
Yeah, we were improv specialists. That's what we did. We just went out there and just did it. We, you know, whatever. They gave us very minimal, just a very minimal outline. Go out there and do it your way. Which is great. I miss that part of the art form, part of wrestling, that the improvisation. I love just getting out there and just – my favorite part now, not when I was younger. When I was younger, I was scared to death. But now is going in completely blank. Who's up? Who's down? Who's going to win? Who's going to lose? And then just do the rest of it out there. That's – especially when you know somebody, that's the best.
I've always felt that way, and I, you may be going to get to this in a second, but the first big match I had with Eddie in the Staples Center, Pat Patterson sat down with us and gave us the finish of what was they wanted, and here's what – you know, Pat was a great finish guy. And I could see Eddie just kind of looking at him, and you could see Eddie kind of glaze over, and Eddie didn't say anything. So when Pat left, I said, Eddie, something wrong? He said, yeah, I don't like it. He goes, I just don't feel that. And I said, well, what do you want to do? And he said, I want to call it out there. So I went to Pat, and much respect to Pat, I said, Pat, I said, just not feeling it. And he said, what do you want to do? I said, Eddie wants to call it out there. We didn't even have a finish. We knew what the finish was going to be. We didn't even have a finish. The entire thing was called out there. But that's also how much respect that Pat had for Eddie as well. That's not a normal thing that would have happened with anybody else in a main event of a pay-per-view where you say, okay, go out there and do whatever you want. But that's the amount of respect that Pat had for Eddie. But that's also that mindset of the older generation of, I want to get out there and feel the crowd and see what they're buying and what they're not.
Yeah, for sure. That's as you get in the business and you get older in the business and you get time in the business, I remember, put this way. So I remember one time I was in the Philippines and I was wrestling Chuck Palumbo. I was the heel, he was a baby face, and Ricky Steamboat, one of the best baby faces, best wrestlers of all time. He was our agent. So he suggested doing some stuff. So I'm like, all right, okay. I wasn't really feeling it, but okay. So I went out there and did it. Match was for me, at least, lackluster. When I got done the next day, I looked at Ricky and I said, Ricky, do you mind? I go, man, I'm not you. You're Ricky Steamboat. There's one Ricky Steamboat and that's it. I'm not you. I can't do that. Can I just go out there and feel it and do it the way I would do it? He's like, yeah, absolutely. Go for it. So I went out there and did it. He came back and, you know, Ricky was his dip in his mouth and chav him. You're right. So it was just, at first you try it, but then after a while, you know, time in the business, you kind of start learning like, okay. And I remember before, right, your match with Eddie, after he and I had a split, he had just gotten the championship from Brock, and Pat suggested something that we did, and we had a match. I had won the cruiserweight championship that before, he had won the heavyweight championship. So, you know, me being the jealous nephew, challenged him for the championship at the next night, whatever. Well, Pat was our agent, and he suggested something, and Eddie wasn't feeling it too much, but we did it, and it worked out fine. But I remember him going like, oh, man, I don't really feel that too much. Let's just try it. So I don't know if that had any play in what you guys did, but I remember your match was, it's one for the ages, you know, and all called on the fly.
all called on the fly. Eddie would do some stuff on the fly that just boggled the mind. I mean, I remember him calling backdrops onto tables and the announce table and different things that was just called on the fly. And I tell people this stuff was all 100% called on the fly. People have a hard time believing it because of the stuff that Eddie did. But he had a feel that was just uncanny. I never seen anything like Eddie. I'm not sure if you ask Eddie, okay, Eddie, put together a match in the back. I don't think Eddie could do it. I don't think Eddie could put a promo together back too. But you give him a microphone and you turn that light on, that guy comes alive, man. It was like a live wire. It was like grabbing something that's not grounded and just shocks through your body, man. It's infectious when you're out there with him, because when he's feeling it, and he felt it almost every single night. I don't know if we ever had a night where he wasn't on. There's a couple that I wasn't. It was an amazing time. I mean, just absolutely amazing stuff that he would come up with. We followed The Undertaker, and I love Taker. He's one of my best friends. He's a groomsman at my wedding. But when you put guys on before the main event, they generally tried to outdo the main event. that was the old mantra, follow this.
MFers, yep.
You want to follow the killer, you better get a pine box. Taker was on before us, and me and Eddie are sitting there watching it, and it was awesome. I don't remember who he was working with. It was freaking awesome. And I'm sitting there going, Eddie, what are we going to do? It was fantastic. And I know that he did it on purpose. He never would admit that. He never would say it. But, that was just the professionalism of, all right, follow this. So I get out there with Eddie, and I had in my mind what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to the top rope. I wanted to go to the crowd. I wanted to keep everybody on their feet. I wanted to go blood and guts. I wanted to go all over the place. And Eddie said, grab the headlock. And so I said, okay, Eddie. And I called a spot, and he goes, nope, sit here. And I said, okay, Eddie. And I called a spot. He goes, sit here. And I thought, what is he doing? So I said, Eddie, we're going to lose him. He goes, sit here. And all of a sudden it occurred to me, of course, you can't keep them up here. You got to bring them down. And we sat there and people started almost murmuring among themselves. They almost got disinterested. And once they did, Eddie said, let's go. And we started going. And by the time we're done, the people are all on their feet. They're going freaking nuts. But it was all Eddie having a feel for the crowd, that so many people forget. And I'd panicked because I wanted to follow Taker. And I wanted to keep them here, but I realized you can't do that for 30 minutes. You got to take them on the roller coaster, and that's what Eddie did.
Yes, Eddie said one time, and I remember Matt Hardy telling me that it was one of the most profound things to him. He said, sometimes you got to bring them down to bring them back up.
That's right. You have to. You can't keep them here. If there's any mistake I see that's made, among young guys of any era, of my era, of the era before me, of the era now, is you try to just spot, and you don't tell a story. You got to be able to lead to that big spot, tell a story, be a little Shakespeare, and then when you get to that spot, everybody goes crazy. But if you get to that big spot after you follow three other big spots, people don't go as crazy.
Yeah, and that's where I think people are mistaking what we do in the ring, and especially young wrestlers. We tell stories in the ring, and the spots help tell the story, but the spots themselves are not the story. I relate it to movies a lot. Explosions in a movie will help tell the story, but the explosions themselves are not the story. And you can't just have a movie which is explosion, explosion, explosion without being connected to your characters, and in our case, to the wrestlers. The wrestlers have to connect to the fans, and the fans have to care about you. If they don't care about you, it's just movement in the ring.
Yeah, and that's what you see in a movie. I mean, every movie is almost the same. I mean, a few kind of differ from that template, but they establish the good guy right away. And they establish that the good guy is a badass in some respect or another. You also establish part of the bad guy. You don't have to establish that guy right away. You can do that throughout the movie, but you do that usually through some fast type scene. You establish that good guy, you establish who the guy is in the white hat, then you take him on the roller coaster. Then you show, okay, here's the bad guy. Here's the guy that's got to be vanquished at the end, and then it takes a while to get there, but that's the roller coaster. Otherwise, a movie would be 15 minutes. you know, if I was writing Walking Dead and I'd been got my way, the governor would have been killed the first 15 minutes of the first show. I had to watch two seasons to see this guy get his head cut off or whatever happened to him. You know, that's the business. You know, you can't you if you want to kill a territory, let the fans book it. Because they're going to do what they want. You can't give them what they want. You know, I don't want to see a movie and get what I want because I want to see Joffrey, you know, King Joffrey get killed right away in Game of Thrones. Instead, you know, you take him out for several seasons, but that keeps you interested.
Absolutely. I agree. And today is, as of this recording, today is October 9th, and it is Eddie's 53rd birthday. So... definitely talking, you know, to you is definitely a highlight for me. So I'll give Eddie a big old cheers because
cheers, I don't like to whiskey, but I have an energy drink. I'll happily
I miss that.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Yeah. Being Eddie's birthday today, let's talk about your program with Eddie. He just become the champ, the WWE champion. And his real first program was with you, right?
Yeah, it was. They needed somebody to work with Eddie. And they, right. I thought my career was really over. I tore a bicep and when I was trying to recover from it, I had two different hernia operations. I mean, I went through some really tough time physically and I thought my career is probably over at this point. And the WWE called me. I can't remember who it was. I don't think it was Vince. I think it was somebody else. And they said, we want you to cut your hair, go back to the original hair color. We need somebody to fight Eddie at the next pay-per-view. And I'd already come back with a different hair color before, you know, that, but
right. I said, yeah, you're coming from the Acolytes with dark hair and goatee and
I took that time off and I came back with Ron and Ron and I split up and we had this kind of idea in mind, but it all boiled down to Eddie needed somebody. Big Show was out, I believe. Kurt Angle was out. Brock had left. I think he was going to UFC, I believe, or NFL, one of the two. Mm-hmm. And so they needed somebody in 6 weeks to get ready for Eddie at the Staples Center. And so that's when they created the JBL character. And so, yeah, it was Eddie's first big program. And for me, this was it. If this hadn't worked, it'd been one and done. I always say if it hadn't been for Eddie, there'd be no JBL. There wouldn't be a Hall of Fame unless I got in there as an APA member or tag team partner, Ron Simmons, which probably was not likely. But it was all came down to Eddie and that first big run that we had and how much input he had into my character.
So I remember one thing that really stands out to me. So I remember the first time I see you on TV, you come out and now you're this JBL character with a big cowboy hat on and stuff. I'm like, oh, where did that come from? Okay. Then you started getting off and running. And I was like, all right, well gosh, dang, this guy can talk. I never really heard you talk before being an acolyte and being the APA. So and I'm like, wow, this guy's really good. So then one thing that really worked that I really liked was that you were not afraid to get heat and keep that heat. So many people now are just like, they want to be the cool heels or they want to be cool out there. You didn't care about that. You wanted everybody in that entire building to boo you. That's the heel I grew up.
I mean, I wanted to be the bad guy. You know, you look at any major TV show, there's always one super bad guy. You know, there's always a bunch of, you know, that are kind of wisecracking, that are kind of middle card and stuff. But there's always this one super bad guy with absolutely no redeeming qualities. And very few guys are willing to be that guy. And that's the guy that I wanted to be. And that's the guy that Eddie needed to work against in that pay-per-view. And so we had to get there and somehow find a way to compress time. And heat never bothered me. I mean, I loved it. I mean, I was a heel 24/7. People say, oh, you're an asshole. No, well, okay. Undertaker was Undertaker 24/7. You say that was professional, and guy does the same thing as a heel, and people say, oh, you're an asshole. But that's what helped protect the character. I never allowed them to sell JBL shirts. I never allowed them to sell JBL merchandise because I didn't want some kid buying a JBL shirt and being wearing that shirt in the front row and people looking around going, well, this kid likes him. Maybe there's something redeeming about it. You know, but after a while I got where people would wear the hat and the towel and wear the suit to the arena. First thing I'd do is I would just lambast these guys on the microphone and I would get them booing me. And once they did, everybody else was already booing me anyway. You know, it was just a matter that you couldn't do anything socially redeeming. And when we first started with Eddie, fortunately, you know, he had such professionalism. You know, the idea is you can make a broomstick into an opponent. Eddie, I think, wanted to see me succeed as much for me and him because we were good friends, but also because of his own legacy of he wanted to show that he could create anybody, and he helped create the JBL character.
There's no Luke Skywalker without Darth Vader.
That's exactly right. I was the perfect foil for Eddie. You know, I was played this ultra right-wing conservative rich guy who hated immigrants, who hated anybody who didn't look like him. I grew up with those guys. You know, Eddie grew up in El Paso. I grew up in West Texas as well. I knew who those guys were. I hated them. And that's what I patterned myself after. So Eddie and I understood very well what worked in that particular scene and what worked in that particular role. And Eddie would call me all the time. He's the one that gave me the line. He said, hey, S.A., tell them my ancestors came over here in a boat, not an inner tube. I just laughed. I said, fed me more lines. And he would call me at all times of the day and night. And he would say, S.A., I got something for you. And he would tell me some line. You know, it was him and your dad that came up with the idea for the heart attack angle in El Paso.
That's where I was going, man. You read my mind because that was so much heat. So we're in, anybody watch, listening, go back and watch that angle. You have in El Paso, home of the Guerreros. And this wasn't even on TV. This was a house show, non-televised show that we recorded to show this later. And we had my grandmother who lived there, my actual grandmother, Eddie's mother, was the matriarch of the Guerrero family. And you tell it, man.
It's also a Mother's Day weekend. So let me tell you the funny part first. The whole thing is pretty interesting. But your dad, Chavo, and Eddie came to me in a dressing room. I don't know where we were. It was right before this, maybe 2 weeks before. They said, we have an idea for the JBL character. Well, tell us what you think. We want to give mom, talking about your grandmother, a heart attack in El Paso on Mother's Day weekend during a ceremony where they're honoring Gory Guerrero, her passed away husband. And I said, oh my God, that's the greatest thing I ever heard. Well, then it gets worse because your dad knows that he's got Eddie on the hook. And he says, Eddie, I've got an idea. Now, it's just us three in the back dressing room. They're going over this and a million angles and sidelines and chasing rabbits. He goes, how about somewhere in there where Big John gives her the clothesline? And Eddie looked at him and goes, Chavo, that's not funny. He's not clotheslining our 70-something-year-old mother. And he goes, no, John can work. He'll make it look good. Now, Eddie starts getting mad. And so Eddie goes, Chavo, shut up. This is not going to happen. He's not touching our mother. He goes, okay, Eddie, okay. He goes, how about he just gives her the big boot? And then Eddie up to fight your dad. And they're like sitting there yelling at each other. And I'm sitting there going, what the – what the hell do I do? guys, two brothers who probably been in a million freaking fights, one needle in the other, and he's got Eddie hook, line, and sinker. It was awesome. So and we finally
I don't think my dad was kidding all much. He was kidding, but he wasn't all that kidding. If he would have went for it, grandma would have went for it, he's like, okay, we could do it. You can do this, bro? And you would be like, yeah, I can do it. Oh, man.
It was so good. So we get to El Paso. They have the state troopers there. They have people everywhere. They think the place could riot. I mean, they're really concerned about that. So I work with Eddie. Match is over.
Hold on 1 second. Someone's knocking my door. Hold on real quick. Hold on. I'll end up that. Oh, great. Thank you. Appreciate it. All right. I'm in quarantine, sorry, and they keep giving me some gifts.
Super. I like it.
Amount of tequila, and I don't know who this is from, but I'm going to read it in a minute. So I'll edit all that out. So let me see. Go back to where you at.
Yeah, so I'd wrestled Eddie earlier in the night, and then he has right after the match. I believe right after the match, I believe is how the timeline went. Bruce Prichard was down there to film it. We're filming it secretly, so nobody knows, so it looks like it's more legitimate and like that's it was right. News footage. And Eddie then comes out, brings his mother out, your grandmother, and the whole place is chanting "Gory, Gory," you know, for the legendary Gory Guerrero. You know, your mom, grandmother has gotten a little bit emotional. You know, that's her husband, not ex-husband. Right. Husband. You know, and she's the widow. And I come back out with a chair and I hit Eddie over the head with a chair and I cut him open with the chair a little bit, caught him with the edge, which added to the effect. Mm-hmm. Eddie had bloodied me earlier with the punch. So I had some blood coming down the front here. So I'm bleeding, Eddie's bleeding. And I turn around to Eddie's mother. And I point at her like that. And when I do, she grabs my wrist. That way she can guide herself down. You know, she's 70-something years old. So she can guide herself down. But it looks like I'm choking her down. So she goes down. Vicky is screaming and crying at ringside. Eddie's daughters are crying and screaming. It's the dangest sight you've ever seen in your life. That place got so quiet, you could hear a whisper from the top row. I've never felt anything like that in my life. It was white heat as white heat. Oh my God, as you could possibly get. Eddie looks up from the mat and he goes, "SA, you better get out of here. They're going to kill you." He was dead serious. The police around the ringside, they're going, "John, you got to get out of here. There's going to be an absolute riot." I never felt anything like that in my life. But I know we got to get it all on camera. So I'm still – and Eddie's mother, I know that she's okay. She looked like she had a heart attack, and I'm 2 feet from her. I mean, imagine what – and I'm in on it. Imagine what people were thinking at ringside. They think that something really serious has happened. And as I'm backing out of the arena, they've got my car not only packed but running outside with the police escort to get me out of town. I come in the back and people are everywhere and I'm yelling at them. I know I'm on camera. I'm yelling at them. I'm thinking, this is going to end really badly. They're going to kill me. That place was just rumbling with hate. Rumbling. It was insane to be there. I get in the car. I drive off. They get me on the interstate. I pull over and I said, "Guys, nobody followed us. I'm fine." They said, "Listen, go all the way to Odessa. Do not come back to town. We can't guarantee your safety." And I said, "Okay, fine." So they turned around and went back. The funny part was I get stopped by a Border Patrol checkpoint about 2 miles later. So I'm in wrestling trunks, wrestling boots, no shirt. All my clothes are in the back, and I've got blood all down me from where Eddie had busted me open with a punch. And this cop pulls up to me. That's what he looks at. I mean, he said, "Is there an explanation?" And I look at him, and he's like a Latino officer, and I thought, he's probably a Guerrero fan. I said, "I've got an explanation. Not sure if it's going to make sense to you." And he goes, "Just put your shirt on and keep going." And so I went out and got my shirt and kept going. And after that, everywhere we went, we had jumpers and rings. So we were in Southwest United States after that time, huge, you know, Hispanic population. Everywhere we went, I had to have extra security. There were people that were jumping, trying to get into the ring. It was crazy. It was absolutely insane. We were worried that we couldn't sell tickets for the Staples Center. We not only sold tickets, when I'm told it was, we set the attendance record that Roy Jones Jr. broke several years later. I mean, everybody was there to see me get killed. And I owe every bit of that to your dad and to Eddie.
Dude, your heat was so intense. And we didn't do it at the Don Haskins Center at UTEP. We did it at the old Coliseum that was the home of the Guerreros and the Guerrero promotion for years. So historic to have it done there. Just that there's some special times in this business, and that was one of them, you know. That was one of those times, just You couldn't recreate it if we tried. It just was perfect.
In my event, it just happened to work out just by luck. We were in San Bernardino. We were a lot of towns in Southwest the United States. And it was, you know, 95% Hispanic that would be there. And the heat that we would get, that I would get, was just absolutely insane. One time we had a jumper. Yeah. We had a jumper, and Eddie gets mad because this guy tries to jump in the ring. He's coming after me. Eddie goes after him because it ruined his – Eddie thinks he's ruined his match. So I literally tackle Eddie, and I'm holding him down. I'm going, Eddie, I'm the bad guy. I'm the one that needs to beat up this fan, not you. If you do it, they're not going to understand why you did it. So he's going, this guy ruined our match, but Eddie, please. And at that point, Little Hebner punted this guy like Ray guy right in the face, punted this guy, knocked him down. Security guy dragged him back. So I come out, I get on the microphone, and I said, listen, security's gone now. Anybody else want to jump in this ring? I promise you, I'll whoop this whole stadium if it takes me 5 minutes. So come on over. And Little Hebner looks at me and he goes, you're the dumbest son of a bitch I've ever seen. He goes, they're going to kill us. And I said, listen, you watch my back, I'll watch yours. We'll be fine. And he goes, what's wrong with you?
I love it. Awesome. That's amazing. Amazing. It's something that we skipped over and definitely kind of out of order a little bit, but we can't have a JBL story or a JBL podcast without talking about Big Ron Simmons.
Yeah, my best friend. Ron was the best man at my wedding. You know, I think the world of Ron, and my biggest break in my life. You know, I always say, without Eddie, there wouldn't be a JBL, but without Ron, there wouldn't be me. I mean, just period. I mean, that's how much I think about Ron. Ron and I were best friends in the WWE. We rode together long before we were tag team partners. It wasn't like we became tag team partners and became friends. That's why they put us together. You know, Ron was there, and they really didn't have anything for him, which was kind of crazy, and they didn't have anything for me, which was probably kind of normal. And they put us together in this tag team, and it just gelled. From the first time we were together, I mean, it just worked. And we had more fun than any two human beings should ever be allowed to have. It was me and Ron and Teddy Long and a lot of times Charles Wright, the Godfather, riding in a four-door car, driving all over the United States together, and sometimes the entire world. We had an absolute ball. I think the world of Ron Simmons.
Ron Simmons is – so everybody knows Ron Simmons as the pro wrestler, but he was one of the greatest college football players of all time. And Bobby Bowden, the coach for FSU, Florida State, said that he was the best college football player that he ever coached.
And he coached about Deion Sanders.
Yeah.
And that was Ron. Yes. He said Ron was the one that brought Florida State into promise. Ron was a three-time All-American. He was a runner-up for the Heisman Trophy as a nose tackle. When they played Oklahoma, they asked Barry Switzer, said, what do you got to do to beat him? He goes, we got to figure out how to block Ron Simmons. He said, that's the key to Florida State. You know, and nobody did. I mean, Ron was a man.
he was a man among men.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Because there were some tough, tough guys back then. You know, he talks about going against Dave Remington, who was that great center with those massive arms from University of Nebraska. Ron had a Trans Am with his picture painted on it in college. Briscoe's seen it. Talk about the big man on campus.
Oh, my God.
Sports Illustrated called him one time, and they said, we want to ask you, how does a kid with no parents grows up in foster homes go to Florida State and have a Trans Am, brand new, with his picture on it? And Ron says, I guess I'm just good with my money. That's the last guy I'll ever roll over on anybody.
He's the most explosive person I've ever seen. He just – you know, he's not a guy that you could sit there and go to the gym and he's going to be benching 600 pounds, but he picks up, you know, like a 100-pound dumbbell like it's nothing. And I've never seen somebody manhandle Big Van Vader like the way he would.
Oh, my goodness.
He was so explosive and so strong.
Yeah, that was in a match that Nick Patrick was a referee, and I've heard Nick Patrick tell the story. Vader hits Butch Reed in the corner and almost knocks him out. Ron tagged me. And he came in and he took down Vader, and Vader right away said, brother, it's a work, it's a work, it's a work. I mean, Ron, when he was a rookie at the Cleveland Browns, He bench pressed 225 48 times. At the time, the NFL record had been Lyle Alzado at 47. Years later, when I was – my year when I came out and people were in the combine, Mandrich did it 43 and everybody fell all over themselves. Ron had done it 48 8 years earlier. I mean, he was world-class strength. Wow. And it was just all God-given.
And his – I never saw his heart rate get over 80.
No,
the guy never got excited. I was just sitting there. You know, one time – They were sitting there, and Steiners, I know the story, and you know that story, where the Steiner brothers were notorious bullies and were constantly messing with people in the locker room and taping them up. And, you know, they would do crazy stuff, you know, do stuff, you know, phallic stuff with Sharpies and stuff, yeah.
They'd tape guys naked in the ring post in the early afternoon, leaving there all day.
Yeah, for sure. And it was just fun for them. Yeah. And somebody asked Ron, so Ron, how come, you know, the Steiners fuck with everybody. How come they don't fuck with you? And Ron goes, because I'm unfuckable.
Ron walked into WWE and he had that horrible blue helmet, that Spartacus top gimmick. Stone Cold Steve Austin said, that's the only guy who can walk around here with that stupid blue helmet and nobody say anything about.
No one will say, don't say a word to him, right? And I actually saw this one. So Eric Bischoff, you know, was the head of WCW, was, you know, the big rival for WWF for years and years. And then, of course, WWF overtook them when Eric came and worked for WWF. And he was in the dressing room dressing with us in the dressing room. And Ron's sitting there, and Ron's sitting it combing his hair with his little pick brush, kind of combing his hair a little bit, making it nice. And someone looks over at Eric and goes, who's that? And Ron looks over and goes, nobody. It's always said, nobody. Didn't say a word, just nobody. And I was like, this guy is, he was on a completely different level than anybody. What was the story? You guys were in a Indian reservation and
it's a great story. It was, we were up in Canada at a bar, and it was a native type reservation place. And so I'm sitting over in the corner. Ron is there, and you can tell these guys really didn't want us being there. You know, they didn't want us in their place. So Ron is across the room, and I'm sitting there, and I hear that they're talking about jumping somebody. And I thought, the only person that's going to jump is me. And I'm sitting there, I look over at Ron, and I thought, oh, boy, this isn't going to end well. And so finally, when it starts to go down, I catch the guy with a pretty good punch. But when I do, knives come out, and they've got me backed up against the corner. And so I can see Ron across the bar, and he comes running to me with knives all pointed at me. There was probably four or five guys who had knives. Ron hops in front of me, grabs a beer bottle, and he looks at this guy, and he goes, I'm going to hit the first white motherfucker that moves. And I thought, I'm the only white guy in this place. And so I've been drinking. I thought, why is he going to hit me? And I'm sitting there trying to figure this out. I thought, Ron's got a beer bottle. This is kind of cool. And I said, I've got no chance of making it out of here. But if Ron turns on me too, I've really got no chance of making it out of here. That's what I'm thinking. And I'm sitting there looking at Ron. And Ron realizes what he said. He looks around and he goes, not you. These guys look at us like, these are the two craziest people we've ever seen in our life. So finally the guy said, all right, you can get out of here, but get out of here now. So me and Ron back down the hall like that and got out of there while these guys had their knives out playing tough.
And your driver, I heard, was nowhere to be found.
Cactus was gone. Nowhere to be found. I told the main bouncer, I said, listen, you've got to get us a cab here, and you got to get us a cab here in minutes. And we're in the middle of nowhere. And I said, because if you don't, there's going to be a lot of bloodshed, and most of it's going to be ours. And I said, but we're not going down lightly. And that guy had us a cab there within 2 or 3 minutes. We got in that cab, and those guys are all still standing there just wanting to stick a knife in somebody. We got out of touch.
So many stories. We've gone on forever on these, and I love them. Now, you left – not left, but you went from being the sports guy and getting beat up and beating people up, and then all of a sudden decided, maybe I should use my brain and invest some of this money. How did you go out being and get into the stock market? How did you go about that route?
I got in the stock market in, say, around 97 during the Asian crisis. I'm thinking about Applied Materials and Oracle, which the first two stocks I bought. I got real lucky because they were at a down because then they shouldn't have been, and I did really well with those stocks. And I started just reading. When I got done playing football, I didn't have any money. I'd love to tell you it was drugs and hookers, and it was none of the above. It just, I didn't have any money. You know, you didn't make much money back then. And I swore to myself, right, if I ever made money, I was going to know what to do with it. So I just started reading every book I could get on finance. I ended up writing a finance book because I thought I can actually write a better book than what I'm reading. And then around 2003, 2004, wind power started taking off in West Texas, where I grew up in Nolan County, Sweetwater, Texas. It's the wind capital of the world. So I talked to some buddies. I said, let's get some land, let's get some turbines and build a wind farm. So I talked to an investment bank there in New York City, a little small boutique bank, Northeast Securities, about building this wind farm. Well, right when we got ready to pull the trigger, we had the land, we had the turbines, we had the loans, we had everything we needed. The renewable energy credit market exploded, absolutely exploded, and just disintegrated. That was our profit margin. So we had to pull the plug. The investment bank looked at me and said, hey, we love what you did putting the land together and the turbines and the financing. Would you come work for us? So I had to go pass my Series 7, Series 63, and all the different stuff to become an investment banker. So I went to work on Wall Street for about 3 years up until the financial crisis. And that's where the whole stock stuff came from. We did micro deals, deals up to, say, $40 million, you know, whatever it was below Goldman Sachs at the time. You know, you couldn't – Goldman mm-hmm. Sachs was the gold standard at the time, especially. So we did deals that were just underneath what was worth it for them, and did a bunch of deals in renewable energy and nutrition, all kinds of different deals.
Wow. That's I love that. It's amazing. What's the name of your book?
Have More Money Now. I wrote it, I think, in 2004, but it's like an evergreen book. Mm-hmm. I wrote it more as a narrative right. than I wrote it just as a financial manual. I wanted people to be mm-hmm. able to read the book and enjoy it, not just say, okay, I'm mm-hmm. trying to learn about PE ratios and crap like that.
Right.
You learn about that stuff, but I've got all kinds of stories in it as well that hopefully when you read it, you can sit it down and just enjoy the book. Hopefully it flows from one end to the other.
Awesome. That's one thing that definitely look up to you and a lot of the wrestlers do, that you did something with your life. you made something of yourself, kid. And you actually, you know, you have your own show.
I worked for Fox Business for years doing, you know, financial analysis and stuff. Bulls and Bears mm-hmm. was our show that we did for so long, and we did on Saturday mornings. It was the number one show on Fox News for the entire weekend. But when Lachlan Murdoch took over, from what I understand, I hope I'm, you know, repeating rumors that from the, you know, not from firsthand stuff, he wanted everything live. And we taped our show on Friday night after the market closed. So they went live on Saturday morning. So that killed our show about a year or two ago. They moved to the Fox Business Channel, but it wasn't quite the same. So now I just kind of mm-hmm. do whatever show kind of wants me on to talk about finance or stocks or market moves and things like that.
Every time I turn on the TV and flip through the channels and I always see you on there, I'm like, all right, that's cool. You got your stuff. And I listen to you and I'm like, all right. I'm waiting for you to spill some bullshit out there, but you know your stuff.
I do all my own investing. I do all my own research. I really enjoy it. You know, I'm very conservative. You know, I'm not into day trading. I'm not into month trading. I invest long-term in companies that I feel comfortable with are going to grow. You know, when you buy a stock, you're buying part of a company. You want to have that company succeed. You don't just buy a stock because it's $20 and you think it's going to 25. You hope it's going to 25, right. But you got to have a rationale for it to get from 20 to 25. And that has to be a company that's behind it that is growing at that rate.
We end Suplex and Cervezas with a quick rapid fire questions to where there's no right or wrong answer. You just for your fans to kind of know a little bit more about you. Are you down for that?
Absolutely. Whatever you want.
All right, man. So are you a vintage car guy or a new car guy?
Vintage.
Nice. Are you a beer or wine?
Oh, beer. No doubt.
I knew that one. I didn't have to. That's just for our fans. Coors Brewing Company or Anheuser-Busch?
Coors. 100% Coors Light.
We're Coors Light fans from till death.
Cowboy champagne.
That's it. That's it right there. Blonde or brunette?
Blonde.
Blondie.
I better say blonde. That's my wife.
Yeah, I'm happy you're still an overachiever there. Butter boobs.
Eddie was a groomsman at my wedding.
I know he was. I know he was. I know he was.
Had a good time.
Are you a butt or boobs guy?
Oh, that's close. That's a toss up. Butt.
Okay. Are you an In-N-Out burger or a Whataburger?
Whataburger. Oh, give me a break. Come on.
Texas boy. If you're from West Coast, you're In-N-Out. If you're anywhere around Texas area, Louisiana, you're Whataburger. Wrestling questions. Are you a Waffle House guy or a Cracker Barrel guy?
Neither one. I never really got into either one. So I was neither.
Really?
Yeah, we never – in Texas, we didn't have Cracker Barrels and we didn't have Waffle Houses. That was more of a southern, like Georgia and Florida and places like that. So never really –
But just being on the road, you must have not have been able to eat because –
Bob Evans. Bob Evans was the place we went a lot of times.
All right, Bob Evans, I'll give you that. I'll give you that. You're a sports guy. Are you an MMA or boxing guy?
MMA. Grew up boxing, loved heavyweight division. Grew up in the era of Ali and Holmes and Foreman and those incredible guys, Frazier. And now you know, there's not really great heavyweights now, and so I don't really enjoy boxing much. I'm an MMA guy.
Were you an Ali or Tyson?
Ali. Come on, man. Loved Ali. Ooh. I still remember like it was yesterday when he won the title back from Spinks.
Amazing boxer, the man.
Thomas Hitman Hearns. I loved Mike Tyson, but that's comparing.
Of course. Of course. I mean, yeah, he'll tell you. Thomas Hitman Hearns or Marvelous Marvin Hagler?
Hagler. Loved Hagler. Hitman Hearns invited me and Ron to a fight he produced. It was that Glotta fight with Mike Tyson when Glotta walked out. So Hitman Hearns is a friend. I consider him a friend, at least, of ours. So I love Hitman Hearns. That fight he had, best three rounds in boxing history. That
the
first
best.
Round, greatest round in the boxing best. History he had with Hagler.
The best. MMA, Chuck Liddell or Randy Couture?
Oh, close. I'll take Couture due to longevity. Just due to longevity. I think Couture was such a tough guy for so long. I love Liddell, too.
Wrestling-esque question. When we are at 300 miles, we can sometimes either fly or drive. What did you like?
Drive. Drive, because we get beer. We get beer and just cruise.
Exactly.
And drive. It's me, Ron Simmons, Godfather, and Teddy Long. Who doesn't want to ride with that crew? we had some awesome times on the road.
And that's what you learn, man. That's what you learn was on the road by picking veterans' brains. And I don't know if it's done too much anymore, but you jumped in the car with somebody. You were lucky enough to get in the car with an Undertaker or an Arn Anderson or a Fit Finley. And that was like the learning tree right there, you know? And last one, are you a Stallone or Arnold guy?
Arnold, 100%, man. Loved Arnold.
Get to the chopper!
Greatest bodybuilder of all time, biggest movie star when I was in college. Real estate made millions of dollars. I mean, there was nothing like Arnold. Nothing like
and
Arnold.
And such a nice guy. He's such a nice guy, right? Oh. You talk to him, and he's got that big 1,000-watt smile. And, hey, you're looking good, man.
Backstage one time at the we're in LA, and he was so
Staples probably
top of the world at the time, and he was asking guys humbly and politely, could his kids take pictures with him, you know, and we're going like, this is Arnold Schwarzenegger, man, you can do whatever you want. And I went up to him and just talked to him, and remember Otto Vance, who I worked for in Europe, he and Arnold were childhood buddies. So I told Arnold in German, I lived in your hometown of Graz working for Otto, and Arnold just lit up like a Christmas tree. And I got to talk to him there for, you know, 30 minutes, whatever. It was the time of my life because I idolized him growing up.
Yeah, great guy. A great, great guy. Well, I don't want to take up most of your day. I appreciate you coming after your golf game and sitting down and jumping on this podcast and shooting the shit with me, man. It's, I tell you, that's the best part of this podcast is catching it with my boys.
Well, I love you, Chavo. I always have. You and Eddie both, we've always got along great. And it's such a – when you said you're going to come on podcast, hell yeah. You just want to come on Zoom and talk and not even tape it, I'd be happy to do that.
I'm the same way. I can't wait to one of these days get together again and throw down a few Coors Lights and tell some old stories, man.
Absolutely. You know, your dad told me one time, one of the greatest compliments that I've ever gotten in my life. And, you know, he was being kind to me at the time. We were at Eddie's funeral, and I was, I think, backstage with the family, and because I gave part of the eulogy. And right. He said, today you're a Guerrero. And I thought that was one of the coolest things ever said to me. That was such a nice thing to say at that time and so respectful. I've always cherished that. I always thought that was one of the nicest things I've ever had said to me.
Well, I know that Eddie, you meant a lot to Eddie, and he really appreciated your friendship and appreciated your run together, and you guys were so close. And I think that's when we were just all just immersed in it and just right in the middle of wrestling, and you guys had that awesome program back and forth, and we just saw you take care of him. So you're a Guerrero, brother. You're part of us.
That's part of us, man. Compliment.
It's true. It's 100% true. I love you, man, and I'm here. I'm a phone call away anytime you need me.
Thank you, my brother.
All right. Talk to you, brother.